Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And one of the things that our government really does not want you to know about is the current situation in Afghanistan. All of us know why the United States is in Afghanistan. After September 11, 2001, most Americans learned for the first time where Afghanistan is on the map. We learned that there was a terrorist group named Al-Qaeda and its leader Osama bin Laden that had murdered 3,000 Americans, and that they were being supported by a group called the Taliban that ran a religious theocracy in Afghanistan. Its leader, Mullah Omar, George Bush promised, would be captured along with Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. And the country as one, pretty much as one, went to war against Afghanistan. There was only one dissenter in Congress. Indeed, there was only one dissenter in World War II after Pearl Harbor. And we went to war in Afghanistan, and after a few months, George Bush made the surprising decision to withdraw the great majority of our troops and send them on to another country, to Iraq. So what happened in Afghanistan? What was left when we withdrew? Who is in control of Afghanistan? The Prime Minister, the President, Hamid Karzai, was just in the United States this week, and he complained not just about things going on in his country, the resurgence of the Taliban, the resurgence of violence, but also about American terror. Terror caused by the United States. Torture in Afghani prisons that rivals that in Abu Ghraib. Indeed, there was an article in the New York Times, which I've linked on my site, that gives you all the gruesome details. So what is going on in Afghanistan? How are we to get out of the situation? What is Afghanistan's future like? And what does the United States need to do to help Afghanistan? Is the best thing we need to do just leave? Do we need more troops? To help answer these questions, I've invited John Sifton. He is the country specialist for Afghanistan with Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch is a non-governmental organization that looks at mistreatment of humanity worldwide. And as I said, he's the country specialist for Afghanistan. And I want to encourage you to call in and ask him your questions. All you have to do is pick up the phone, dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the weblog at radioinsidescoop.com. John Sifton, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hello.
Hello. Let me start with asking you about the current situation in Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai was in this country, and he was pleading for help. How much of Afghanistan does Hamid Karzai actually control?
Well, the situation has gotten better over the last 3 years. The government, when it came into existence in the late 2001, really just was on paper. It was an agreement signed in Germany, the so-called Bonn Agreement, that put Hamid Karzai into power. He really didn't have any power, any men, any money in his treasury when he took power. That's a little bit different now. Hamid Karzai does have a government. He does have a treasury. He does command the allegiance of government ministries in Kabul, as well as a few in some outlying regions. But he still has a huge uphill battle in terms of cementing basically a sovereignty in Afghanistan, a functioning state that can do the things that states are supposed to do, tax and provide, you know, resources for citizens, have a police system to protect people from insecurity and from crime, and to do all the other things that we hope, you know, governments do to keep a state functioning. It's a long road ahead, and unfortunately, Hamid Karzai's job has been made difficult both by his own ineptitudes, but also by a failure of the international community to really give him any of the support he needs in terms of finances, but also international security forces, peacekeeping forces, who can help bring some security out to outlying regions.
John, I want to get into all of those issues, the ineptitude, what the international community can do, all of that, and we have a full hour to discuss the issue. I'd like to start by noting that some have derided Hamid Karzai as the mayor of Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, saying he only controls Kabul and a few outlying areas. What percentage of the entire land area of Afghanistan does Hamid Karzai control?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to think in terms of the actual land area. Afghanistan, as a lot of people know, is an extremely rugged terrain. It's a lot of mountains. At the end of the day, the people of Afghanistan don't live in vast majorities of the actual landmass. The important things are the villages and the towns which lie in the valleys between the mountains. And Hamid Karzai does command government officials who are in many of the locations outside of Kabul, such as Gardez, Jalalabad, Kunduz, even Herat out in the west. And obviously Kandahar, where he's from, has a pretty close connection with him. Unfortunately, though, there are other regions where, although local regional strongmen are allied with Karzai, pay him allegiance, you know, say that he is the president, and they don't, you know, they're in no way rebellious against him, they are really running their own private fiefdom there. And basically, they're in charge. And it's very difficult for the Karzai government to sort of stop the worst aspects of that local control from harming individuals.
To what extent is the Taliban or former Taliban still in charge in some areas in Afghanistan?
Well, they're definitely not in charge. The issue is whether they still have the capacity to mount strikes. Basically, there are some areas in the south outside of Kandahar, Zabul province, which is to the east of Kandahar, and then other mountainous areas along the Pakistani border to the east. You have pockets of insurgents, not all Taliban. Some of them, in fact, are members of another guerrilla group called Hizbi Islami, which was a group under the Mujahideen leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who fought the Soviets back in the 1980s. Hekmatyar wasn't allied with the Taliban back in the past, but he certainly has allied with them now, and his group, as well as the Taliban, continue to mount attacks on U.S. forces in a couple of these areas on the border of Pakistan and in the south. But the majority of Afghanistan is not really seeing those problems. If you go to the north, around Mazar-e-Sharif, you know, near Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, there's really no Taliban insurgency at all. Although there are some serious problems with criminal warlordism, it's not really a Taliban insurgency.
How is Hamid Karzai seen by the average Afghani, and to the extent that there's not an average Afghani, perhaps you can describe various groups and how he's seen? I read recently the Taliban has accused Hamid Karzai of being a pawn of the U.S. government, and I'm curious to know whether that kind of statement rings true for a lot of Afghanis, or do they realize that they're certainly better off than they were under the Taliban?
Well, I think many Afghans do recognize that no matter what else no matter what you say, Afghanistan is doing better than it was under the Taliban. But what the second thing they would say is that's not much of a measuring stick, because, of course, anything is better than the Taliban. The Taliban regime in Afghanistan was a disaster for the country. It was a cruel and anachronistic regime that really offered nothing, insofar as it offered security, in the sense that there wasn't ongoing civil conflict going on. It was what one Afghan referred to me as the security of the graveyard. It was a terrible regime, and many people are glad it's gone. But with that said, they've seen a lot of opportunities missed. Afghans remember, although perhaps a lot of Americans don't, that Afghanistan was, once upon a time, before the Soviet Politburo decided to invade it and foment a revolution there in the late 70s, a relatively peaceful place. In fact, for most of the 20th century, it was a rather peaceful place, a place where many Americans and Europeans would go in the summers to backpack. I kid you not, this was a place where sort of more rugged bohemian types used to go in the 50s and 60s.
Like they still go to Nepal and places like that?
Well, Nepal's not doing so well. This was a country that saw a lot of peaceful problems. It had a lot of poverty. It had a lot of underlying instability. It had a lot of serious problems in terms of human rights, especially with respect to women. But it wasn't one that was racked by a civil war. That all changed in the late 70s and then the 80s and 90s. Now what you have is a lot of Afghans returning from being refugees in Iran and Pakistan and even Europe and Australia, and you have a very diverse population who have a lot of different views on where the country should go. Some people are from rural areas. They want to go home and have a livelihood as farmers. Other people are bringing back sort of Western economic ideas, and they want to invest and make a new Kabul. And actually a situation that has a lot of promise, but that's what makes it so disappointing, that the international community and the Afghan government have squandered a lot of that opportunity, a lot of those opportunities.
Now it seems to me that, you're saying that Hamid Karzai's heart is in the right place. He means well. He's trying hard, but he's unable to achieve some of the things that he should be achieving. Is that fair to say?
Well, to be completely fair to him, you know, he's had a tough time, but on the other hand, he has often made overly cautious decisions himself.
Give me some examples of those.
Well, there were times early on in 2002 when it would have been easier for him, it would have been easy for him, in coordination with allies in the international arena and other allies in, on the ground in Afghanistan, to sideline a lot of the military commanders who were sort of pushing their way into the political scene. These were people who fought alongside the United States against the Taliban as military commanders, and who then, once the Taliban was conquered, set out to be political leaders.
But isn't this what...
They don't really enjoy the support of a lot of Afghans, and it would have been very easy for President Karzai at that early point to sort of say, no, you know, your service in defeating the Taliban is we're thankful for it, and you know, you fought the Soviets and we're thankful for that too, but now is the time for this country to rebuild and we need civilian leaders and all that. But that didn't happen. Instead, he welcomed sort of with open arms.
But John, isn't this how Afghanistan has always sort of been run, at least for the several decades now, a sort of a warlording kind of, where you have one province controlled by one warlord and one province controlled by another warlord?
Well,
I don't think
right,
it's anything new.
It was new in 1980.
Okay.
It isn't not how it has always been. You're right to say that it's how it's been done for the last few decades, but this is not, there is no sort of natural state of political affairs in Afghanistan. I mean, the country has undergone massive upheaval and change over the last 25 years, and it's changed the sort of underlying way in which politics happens in Afghanistan. There really is no model, but one thing is for sure, that the warlord model, which has been quite common in the 80s and 90s, is not one which Afghans like. I mean, if you go out there, people are furious. All that people complain about is their poverty and how it is entrenched because of continuing warlordism. And what do they mean when they say warlordism? They mean commanders and their gunmen stealing from people, setting up illegal checkposts on the road and taxing drivers as they go by, extorting money from businesses, and even kidnapping young women and even young boys for sexual purposes. They're angry about it. They're like, this is not the way we want to live, and this is not the way it was, you know, back in the 60s and 50s when this country wasn't, you know, racked by all this militarized warlordism.
So it's fair to say that of the three primary actors in Afghanistan, the United States, Hamid Karzai, and the warlords, clearly the warlords bear the brunt of dislike and distrust by the average Afghani.
Yeah, and then there's good reason for it. I mean...
Okay, I understand. Let me ask you this. Do they blame Karzai or the United States, or both, for not putting down the warlords? Do they want more U.S. troops, for example, to do that?
Well, what they wanted and what they still want is troops to supplement the International Security Assistance Force, which was the force that was created to be peacekeepers in Kabul City initially and then expanded to several other sites. It's not an American force. It's led by NATO and was predominantly staffed by British and European and Canadian troops. They've done a great job in Kabul of stabilizing Kabul, and they've also moved out to Mazar and Kunduz to the north of Kabul, and even now out to Herat in the west. But they're still not deployed in most areas of Afghanistan. A lot of people know that if they were deployed, the situation would get better.
John, help me out here. Well, what in that international force? I know that, for example, in Iraq, more than 90% of the force is American. That's not true in Afghanistan, is it?
Well, you have 18,000 roughly U.S. troops.
Yeah.
And then you have about 10,000 international troops. So
we're about 60%
in the U.S., but when it comes to the people that Afghans face and see in the streets, the majority of them are Europeans, because most of those U.S. troops I just mentioned are barracked. They're combat troops that are there to sort of be called out during combat operations, and otherwise they just spend their time on the base.
This has been fascinating so far. We do have to take a commercial break. When we come back, I want to ask about those combat troops, those American troops, and the allegations that they've been involved in a little bit of terror of their own, or maybe I should say more than a little bit, both the allegations in the New York Times and indeed by John Sifton, our guest of Human Rights Watch. I want to get to that and also want to get to your calls right after the break. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the weblog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? Ha, ha, ha. She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, giving you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. Hamid Karzai was in Washington this week, and he, of course, is the president of Afghanistan, who was installed sort of by the United States, though it was done through a process to give him legitimacy. And our guest, John Sifton of Human Rights Watch, is saying that Karzai, though he's not... appreciated for some of his ineptitude. It really is trying. He's trying to get rid of the warlords that are controlling still areas of the country, and that the people might want some more U.S. help to do that. I want to move on in a minute and talk about some of the not-so-nice things that American troops have been doing in Afghanistan, including the report in the New York Times regarding torture. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. The comment you can also make on the weblog at radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and John Sifton.
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hi, Gordon.
Howdy.
I just like to find out what the current U.S. mission in Afghanistan is. Is it to keep the Karzai government alive? Or, you know, if Osama bin Laden was found and captured tomorrow, how would that change the U.S. mission in Afghanistan?
Two good questions. John?
Well, the U.S. military and the State Department and the White House have been a little bit opaque about what exactly is going on in Afghanistan. Are they fighting the Taliban? Are they fighting the insurgency? Are they looking for Osama bin Laden? Are they trying to stabilize the government? In a way, they're doing all four. I mean, it's just about everything. And I'll just throw into the mix one more thing, which is an obvious but understated desire to stay in Afghanistan, build U.S. bases there, which can then serve as long-term forward operating bases to have U.S. power exerted in Asia. It's always good from a military point of view to have more air bases out there. So that's a fourth and fifth often understated aim of being there. But we have pushed the administration to get more explicit about exactly what their goals are and say, hey, you know, is this insurgency and this counterinsurgency going to go on forever? I mean, it's such a light insurgency. Isn't it time to kind of wrap it up? I mean, perhaps the U.S. forces are just drawing more fire, and if you took them out of southern Afghanistan, a lot of that counterinsurgency might get just wrapped up, and then you could just bring in a lot more peacekeeping troops to provide security for development schemes and just get the whole ball rolling on the reconstruction of Afghanistan. So that's something we've been pushing them on. But with that said, it remains the case that there are some armed groups out there on the Pakistan border who do not, you know, want Hamid Karzai to be in power, and they will continue to make problems for him. Are they a threat to the Kabul government? I don't think so. I think the bigger threat is warlordism and a lack of rule of law. The real problem facing Afghanistan's future, which the administration has to face, is Hamid Karzai being the only man they have, and the country is essentially one bullet away from a civil war.
There's no one to take over if Hamid Karzai is killed?
Well, officially it would pass to the vice president of Afghanistan, who's currently the brother of the slain Mujahideen leader, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Is he not as well respected as Hamid Karzai?
Well, he'd certainly be respected, but what it would do is it would throw the leadership to a relatively inexperienced person who is much more connected with one particular faction, the Mujahideen, and particularly the Tajik Mujahideen, ethnically Tajik Mujahideen leaders. It's all very complex. Afghan politics is very complex. But the bottom line is you do need a broad-based leader to lead the country, one who can sort of appeal to everybody. And what I'm afraid of is that a quick shift in power to another faction, particularly one that is so identified with the Mujahideen and isn't really embracing of the southern part of the country, the Pashtun part, could destabilize the country and cause further harm. I mean, let's not forget, there are warlords in the north who would like nothing more than to grab more power for themselves and at the expense of southern Pashtuns. And likewise, there are southern Pashtuns who would like nothing more than to grab more power for themselves in Kabul at the expense of the northern, predominantly Tajik and Uzbek Afghans. So it's not like the former Yugoslavia. We're not going to have genocide. It's not anywhere like that, but it is very dangerous. It's a destabilizing situation that needs to be stabilized by creating a rule of law, functioning governmental structures so that people can argue through process and parliamentary procedure and words instead of through rockets and artillery and bombs.
Gordon, do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I'm just going to ask, if the U.S. decides to try to make part of their mission attacking warlordism in Afghanistan, wouldn't that be going past a point of diminishing returns and lead to what you were talking about, this inability to call a victory anywhere and lead to endless occupancy by the U.S. forces.
And John, to add to Gordon's question, isn't that kind of what we tried in Somalia, beating down the warlords? Isn't that what failed there?
Well, the thing is, the warlords in question here are not hostile to the U.S. A lot of them fought with the U.S. against the Taliban. And fighting warlordism, is not, even despite the word fighting, is actually not a military effort. It is a developmental effort. It is a political effort. It is an effort to politically convince these commanders that they need to relinquish some of their power, their political power. And it's obviously very delicate. It's work that is extremely diplomatically difficult. You have to basically not wound people's pride, and yet at the same time feel... make them feel like they are continuing to have power while you're actually, in fact, stripping them of their power. But it's something which has been done in many, many countries. It's failed in some countries, like Haiti, and in other places it succeeded. It's a slow process. It takes money, it takes development, and some amount of patronage, but it can work. If you do it right.
John, where has Somalia, as I said, I mentioned, was not a success. Where has this kind of thing succeeded?
Well, I think a few good examples can be seen in Africa, where hopeless conflict situations have slowly started to stabilize, like Sierra Leone and Liberia.
But these aren't U.S. troops causing this.
No, but it's not the... It's not predominantly the U.S. The U.S. alone is not the body which provides all this effort. They just need to sort of let it happen. The UN, EU, NATO, the US together, if they make it their priority to stabilize the country, then the country will be stabilized. But what we've seen is that stabilization efforts have taken the back burner to efforts by the US military to continue this counterinsurgency operation in the south of the country.
So John, what would you recommend that the U.S. military do to instead of counterinsurgency? What kind of stabilization efforts specifically are you supporting?
What I would support is accelerated disarmament of illegal militias. There are literally gangs of armed men riding around the Afghan countryside, stealing, pillaging, and raping young women and boys, literally, setting up illegal checkposts and all that. Disarmament is the effort of taking guns out of people's hands, licensing personal weapons, and basically setting up a legitimate Afghan army and police that carries identification and has uniforms, as opposed to the sort of anybody with a gun is a policeman, which is what you have currently. That would be one thing. The second thing is to help amplify Karzai's political influence in outlying regions by providing him with the tools to offer something to local leaders so that they can stand up against the local commanders who threaten their population. What does that mean? It means, let's say I live in a little town in the north of Afghanistan, and I want to stand up and say, hey, the local gunman is stealing from everybody. If I do that now, I'll be killed. I'll be assassinated by that guy. And Karzai won't even know about it. But if Karzai and the U.S. were making more of an effort to support people like that, support civil society at the local level through grant making, providing money to local professional groups, teachers' unions, human rights groups, humanitarian groups at the local level, as opposed to these enormous international groups which squander a lot of money. All of that taken together, none of it alone will do anything, but all of this taken together can make a huge impact in ending warlordism.
Gordon,
and some of it's going on, but not enough.
Gordon, do you have any last thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, what I'm hearing is that for the U.S. to call anything close to victory, we're going to need an Afghan army to supplant the warlords, and I'm wondering, what is the possible recurring threat of the Taliban coming back?
Not very big, but the bigger issue, I think you're right to say, is the creation of an Afghan army. It's been going very, very, very slowly, too slowly, but it is happening, and it has to move forward. Reform, disarmament and creation of a new military and police. It's not just the military, but also a police force that can fight against the criminality that you're seeing on the ground. A lot of the problems, at the end of the day, is not so much a criminal force threatening people, but criminal gangs who work with the warlords coming in and threatening and intimidating politicians, women's rights activists, and anybody else who stands up to challenge them.
John and Gordon, we have to take a commercial break. Gordon, are you done, or do you want to hang on past the commercial? It's up to you.
Let me hang on.
Okay, hang on. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop. We're going to talk more about the situation in Afghanistan and also the really, I don't know if they're surprising, but disgusting allegations of American torture in Afghan prisons. That's going to come up as well. If you want to dial in and join me and Gordon and John Sifton, all you have to do is dial 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back.
For Anna Briggs, now 94 years young, the ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scruffy mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's baacs.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan!
Magellan? No. Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world!
Right! Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard? Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a
pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie, are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech Language Hearing Association and this station.
A new route to
Asia!
Good.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you the news from Washington and around the world that the government does not want you to know, that is rarely reported. We're talking about the situation in Afghanistan, a country that's gotten not that much attention since we went to war in Iraq. It's gotten a little more attention this week with President Hamid Karzai coming to Washington, talking with President Bush. And my expert, who really knows what's going on the ground in Afghanistan, is John Sifton. He is the country specialist for Afghanistan for Human Rights Watch. I've got a caller, Gordon, also on the line. And if you want to call in and join in the debate, you're welcome to do so. 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We always appreciate your calls. And, John, I want to, before I get to the question of American torture of Afghani citizens, I'd like to know, who are the insurgents? Are they Taliban? Are they just irregulars coming in from Pakistan that are anti-American? Are they warlords? Who is attacking American troops?
Well, it's a ragged bunch of scragglers at this point. I mean, the majority of the people who fought against the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan are now back at home or in barracks. They're with the government. You know, they're part of the status quo.
They're on our side, so to speak.
So to speak. The people who are continuing to fight are either members of Southern Pashtun tribes that were affiliated with the Taliban, or they're members of this Islamic group, Hizbi Islami, which was one of the main Mujahideen groups that fought against the Soviets. Now, the majority of Hizbi Islami has come in from the cold, but a couple of them are still out there, including its leader, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and for reasons that are probably have more to do with pride than with good politics, they've decided to fight the U.S., despite all the odds. They have no support from any nation, and they basically have no hope of ever successfully fomenting change on the ground, but they can still shake things up. I think they're ideologically committed to the struggle, and they're not going to give up. But
well,
there's
John,
very few of them.
If the United States were to leave, would these attacks continue against the Karzai government, or do you think the attacks would wither away?
They might continue, but really, I mean, some of the solutions to these ultimately are political, and it's ugly. But you know, the Afghan government someday will have to, I think, make some kind of agreement with some of the guys out in the hills and say, look, you know, just come in, go home, farm your land, and stop fighting, you know, give it up, and let them go home in peace.
Let me ask you this.
If they don't agree to do it, then you say, okay, go back to the hills, and if we find you, we're going to engage you, and you're going to be killed, but, you know, it's your choice.
John, let me ask you this. To what extent do you believe former Taliban leader Mullah Omar or current al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden are involved in these attacks?
Which the attacks against...
Against the United States.
Well, they certainly are. But, I mean, the bigger concern is, can they be stopped? And I think one thing that hasn't been discussed enough is the extent to which these groups are continuing to receive assistance from elements within Pakistan. I don't mean the Pakistan government itself, but elements within Pakistan who are affiliated with the government, members of its intelligence agency, and other Pakistani forces, whether they're private or governmental, who are interested in seeing these guys still exert some kind of power on the ground.
Well, of course,
in Afghanistan.
These would be the same Pakistani forces and elements that supported the Taliban and al-Qaeda 5 years ago, right?
Well, not precisely. I mean, it's very complex because Pakistan as a state, as a government, put their full support behind the Taliban in 1995, including, you know, the president of Pakistan. What you saw later on was Musharraf, the president and leader of the military ruler, who seized power in a coup. He, after September 11th, decided to cut the Taliban off. I'm not going to work with these guys anymore. I'm going to ally myself with the U.S. And he instructed his army and intelligence service to, you know, go along with him. But what our worry is that some of the military and some of the intelligence forces, while doing what Musharraf says, are in a private capacity still providing support to the Taliban.
I've kept Gordon on the line. Gordon, I'd like you to ask one last question, then I want to move on and talk about the U.S. torture of Afghanis. So go ahead, ask one more question.
Okay, I'd just like to know what the changing image of the U.S. of the U.S. forces is in Afghanistan the longer we stay. Are we being viewed as allies, or are we being viewed as occupiers?
Well, that has a lot to do with the next issue you want to discuss, the issue of U.S. forces abusing detainees in custody. A lot of people, especially in the north, where there hasn't been military operations, at least since, obviously, the Taliban was pushed out, are very happy with the situation, and they see the U.S. as liberators, and they're very happy about what the U.S. has done. In the south of the country, by contrast, where the U.S. continues to do military operations, everybody has a cousin and a brother or somebody who's been arrested by the Americans, and they have a bad experience, and they're mad. Now, they don't think we're like the Russians. They're, you know, that's not like the Soviet army. They're intelligent enough to draw a distinction, but they're still angry about some of the problems that have occurred when U.S. forces have used too much force, have made mistakes, or even some forces have committed outright abuses on purpose. So there's a lot of concern there in the south. But
that's actually a nice segue into the next segment. Gordon, I want to thank you very much for your call. I always appreciate when you call.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to talk about the American mistreatment of Afghani detainees. A lot of this has just come out recently in the New York Times. there it was a front page article talking about what happened in 2002. I should note that I've reported, for at least a couple years now, the stories I had heard from insiders in the government that U.S. torture and mistreatment of prisoners was not confined to Abu Ghraib, that it went on in Guantanamo Bay, that it went on in Afghanistan. But the New York Times report gives graphic details, and I want to read from some of those. Again, you can read the full report if you go to the website, radioinsidescoop.com. There's a link there. But the report begins talking about a 22-year-old slight taxi driver known as Dilawar, who was hauled from his cell at Bagram, Afghanistan at about 2 a.m. to answer questions about a rocket attack. He had been chained by his wrists to the top of his cell for much of the previous 4 days. They talk about how he asked for a drink of water, and a U.S. Specialist picked up a large plastic bottle, punched a hole in the bottom, and the water poured out all over him. And as he gagged on the drink, they tried to force him to his knees, and they pummeled him, and eventually, before he could see a doctor, he lay dead on the floor. This is not the only example. There are many, many examples. Some are pretty gruesome. They involve requiring prisoners to pick plastic bottle caps out of a drum full of excrement, and the list goes on and on. The torture goes on and on. I guess you at Human Rights Watch, John Sifton, it's part of your role to monitor this kind of stuff.
Yeah, we had been reporting on abuses by U.S. forces for some time. We first came across allegations in 2002, in fact, well before the Iraq War even began. And in fact, the worst allegations are about early 2002. In some ways, the situation at Bagram Air Base got better. Today, our concern is not about Bagram, but about the forward operating bases, which are along the Pakistani border, where special forces teams and CIA teams interrogate people they capture during operations. Those places, kind of off the radar screen, the Red Cross has no access to visit detainees there. Anything can really happen, and in fact, some people have died in custody there just in the last year.
John, when you say the Red Cross has no access, are we, the United States, forbidding the Red Cross from getting access to these places?
Well, what the Red Cross has asked for is that if people are going to be detained for more than a few hours, that they be brought to a centralized location. So if they're in the east near Khalistan, they be brought to Gardez, to a main detention center where they can be visited. What they don't want is Afghans being held in little posts, you know, for weeks at a time, because they can't keep track of all these little posts. The military doesn't want the Red Cross or anybody else to know about the existence or location of these little forward operating bases. So, you know, that's the Red Cross's line.
Well, John, tell me this. What is going wrong? The New York Times article suggests quite strongly this is systematic. This isn't an example of one or two guards beating up on one or two prisoners. Yeah. They suggest that, in fact, it's U.S. policy, and yet so few people have been prosecuted for this. Was this U.S. policy? Was this people going off on their own? What do we know about what went wrong here? Why is the United States torturing these people?
Well, there was never any single kind of abuse going on. I want to stress this. All our work in Afghanistan and Iraq, a lot of people think, there's one paradigm for what was going on. Like it was rogue soldiers, or no, it was this, it was that. It was a lot of things. You have, on the one hand, military police, reservists, low-level people handling detainees, low-level detainees who are swept up during, you know, raids. People don't even know who they are. They're just like a bunch of guys. They get brought in.
They may not even be insurgents who attack the United States.
A lot of times they aren't insurgents. And in fact, the majority of people who have been arrested in Afghanistan and Iraq have been released because it turns out that they're not insurgents. So, on the one hand, you got those guys. But then you also have situations where special forces teams with CIA people attached into them are going out on special missions and arresting high-level people who are connected with the insurgency and bringing them back to some detention site. These are different, you know, these are apples and oranges. In the latter case, where the CIA and special forces teams go out and they arrest people, that's where we've seen what very well may be, further investigation is needed, but what very well may be systematic ordered abuse of detainees. That is to say, somebody saying, take the gloves off, do whatever you need to do to get intel out of that. That's illegal. It's a violation of international law. It's a violation of domestic U.S. law. And we've complained about it.
I need to stop you right there. John, we have to go to one last commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk in more detail about the American torture or terror in Afghanistan, who's behind it, what's causing it, what, if anything, has the United States or the world community done to stop it, what can Hamid Karzai do to stop it. We also, I know, have people hanging on the lines. Keep hanging on. We'll get to you right after the break. If you want to join in, there's still some room to call in. 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
What is it about ultra-right conservatives who bill careers as tongue-clucking scolds? They constantly preach about the moral failings of the rest of us, yet they keep getting caught with their own pants down, morally speaking. I don't merely mean the Falwells, Swaggerts, and other publicly compromised televangelists, but also the right-wing politicos who prance about so piously on their moral high horses. For example, how swell to be lectured on family values by Newt Gingrich, who's now on his third marriage, or is it number four? Also, how perfect to have Bill Bennett anoint himself as the nation's arbiter of conservative virtues while he sneaks around feeding his gambling addiction. And who can forget the bombastic moral authority of the airwaves, Rush Limbaugh, using his housekeeper to score illegal drugs for him, then trying to lie about it? Are these people born with an extra hypocrisy gene? It's not just in America, either. Britain is all a-Twitter these days about one of its own especially noisy tongue-cluckers, the Right Honorable Boris Johnson. He's the Latin-spouting, Eton-schooled editor of the right-wing Spectator, a London newspaper long tied to England's plutocratic Conservative Party. Indeed, Boris himself is a Conservative Party member of the Parliament, where he has served as the party's official spokesperson on cultural policies, freely criticizing the personal morality of others. He's now been removed from that party post, however, since it has been revealed that Boris the Moralist, who is married and has four children, has been cheating on his wife, having an affair with a society columnist at his paper. Furthermore, Boris impregnated the mistress, she had an abortion, and he tried to lie about it, initially calling the accusations an inverted pyramid of piffle. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a great phrase! Right-wingers lecturing us on morality are dumping a pyramid of political piffle on us.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the situation in Afghanistan with our guest, John Sifton. He's the country specialist for Human Rights Watch. We've been talking generally about the situation in Afghanistan. And now, in the latter half of the hour, we're talking about the mistreatment of Afghanis by American troops. And indeed, mistreatment is really a bit of an understatement. If you read the New York Times report, which is attached to the website at radioinsidescoop.com, you come away realizing that it's not just mistreatment, it's not just interrogation. There's actually a decent amount of sadism going on. And while I would be the last to compare American troops to Nazis, some of them, when you particularly read the situation, for example, where the interrogators are insisting that the prisoners kiss their boots, or one of the most gruesome examples where you have an emotionally disturbed Afghan detainee who they would beat until he would say the word Timmy like the cartoon character in South Park, basically trying specifically to humiliate these people, sounds to me much more like sadism than it does about anything regarding interrogation. John Sifton, before I get to a caller, who is hanging on the line, and I'll get to you in 1 second, caller. John, I mean, is there any true interrogation purpose to these techniques, or are they just sadistic?
Well, you'd have to ask interrogators whether torture works or not. I think a lot of people say it doesn't. We certainly don't care because we think it's illegal. It is illegal, and we believe nobody should be subjected to it, no matter who they are. But the bottom line is it's not just interrogation which is going on here. We're talking about guards who, for their own purposes, their own sadism, their own racism, just subject people to mistreatment because they want to, because they're on a power trip or whatever else.
Are they being punished?
That's the issue. I mean, we never expected 2 years ago to see such a stunning failure to hold accountable people. We thought, okay, if this breaks, then heads will roll. And when Abu Ghraib broke, I really thought heads were going to roll. They didn't roll. They didn't. We've been really surprised by how timid the CID, the Criminal Investigative Division of the Army, has been in pursuing these cases. You know, they put a couple people away, some of the people who were pictured in the Abu Ghraib pictures. But there are men out there, special forces teams, who have killed detainees, killed them, and given administrative reprimands, letters of admonishment, pay cuts, rank reductions. That's their punishment, administrative. You know, we're talking about murder, and they're talking about pay cuts.
Well, why is that going on, John? I mean, why aren't we punishing the people who did these crimes? Could it be that higher-ups are implicated in this, and they don't want them telling on them? I mean, what's going on here?
What we need is an independent investigation into what's going on to find out what's going on. Because if you don't know, it certainly has the appearance of higher-ups trying to shield themselves from blame. Because, of course, when people are faced with serious punishment, that's when they start accusing the people above them of ordering what happened. Right now, there's a trial going on in San Diego involving a Navy SEAL who's involved in the death of an Iraqi detainee. He's probably going to get off with a late punishment, too, because if he doesn't, he's probably going to start complaining about how the CIA told him to rough up detainees. Anybody's interested in that, you know, look at the news stories out of San Diego written by all the wire services in the New York Times, Washington Post. It's a very interesting case, not really getting that much attention.
I have a caller who's been hanging on the line quite a long time. Caller, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
This is Ed from New York, Mark.
Hi, Ed.
And I'd like to thank your guests for giving me the interesting information, but I'd like to ask him, was the, to the extent that you have any knowledge about it, was the Newsweek riots that took place in Afghanistan, were they trumped up by outsiders, or was this a genuine type of riot in Afghanistan? And was somebody else pushing the Newsweek story so it could be heard all over Afghanistan? In other words, was Al Jazeera broadcasting it or something of that nature?
Good question. Go ahead, John.
Well, there wasn't Al Jazeera, but I will say the whole thing started actually in Pakistan when a Pakistani politician named Imran Khan started waving around that Newsweek complaining about it. It spread to Jalalabad in the east the next week, and then the riots started there. There is actually no single explanation for what started and caused the riots. It was really an intersection of a lot of different causes, including fiery sermons whipped up by local clerics, but also political parties in the east and south of the country, which were seeking to benefit on the story. These are people who are allied with Karzai, and on the Pakistan side, allied with Musharraf, but who saw it as an opportunity to criticize their leaders for cozying up too closely to the U.S. So it was a kind of domestic politics brouhaha that Newsweek played right into. I'll tell you one thing, though. The error in the story, which had nothing to do with the underlying allegation, but had to do with whether it had been confirmed or not by the military.
Right.
Well, that error wasn't what caused the riots. I mean, certainly the person who's most directly responsible for starting the riots is the Pakistani politician who I just mentioned, Imran Khan. I actually wrote an article about this, which is in the American Prospect online this month, if you want to look at it.
Okay. Well, you can post it there.
Can I ask, do we know who the American source of the story was to Newsweek, or is Newsweek still keeping that source confidential?
Well, the thing, I mean, at this point, you know, with all due respect, I have to say, you know, does it really matter? There's so many allegations out there that have been made.
The Red Cross, for example, has confirmed that Americans have mistreated the Quran.
Yeah, I mean, it's the allegation was there. You know, maybe what they confirmed or didn't confirm was whether the military had substantiated it. But, you know, excuse me for asking the government, but since when did we believe something was true or not because the government substantiated it?
Ed, I want to thank you for your call. I would like to know, though, something I think Americans ask, and how it is that the Afghanis or Muslims in general in Pakistan seem to care much less if their fellow citizens are tortured and much more if their holy book is desecrated, or is that not fair?
Well, I don't think it is completely fair. I mean, the riots were about a lot of things, and I think it was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back. We shouldn't confuse the straw with the bulk of the load. I mean, there was a lot of frustration out there already based on mistreatment of individuals, and I think the Quran desecration just sort of was the tipping point.
John, I'd like to address two callers, actually two writers on my weblog who have criticized me, and I want to read their criticisms on the air. This is one by Jacob, and Jacob writes to me, "Why do you hesitate to compare U.S. troops to Nazis? That is what they are. Afghanistan is not about Taliban or Al-Qaeda. It is about Karzai, a UNICAL consultant appointed for the sake of getting a pipeline completed and a permanent military presence in Central Asia. How long are you going to continue to deny the facts, Mark? Osama is only an excuse." John, how do you address that listener?
Well, I'm well aware of these allegations about the pipeline. I mean, all I can say is there are financial interests in every country, but I think it would be a mistake to say that there's just one simple reason why we went into Afghanistan. I mean, there was a devastating attack on U.S. soil. The people responsible for it were alleged to be in Afghanistan. They went into Afghanistan to deal with that. Were there benefits that, you know, go towards financial interests that have nothing to do with September 11th? Perhaps. And should we investigate those if they exist? Yes, but I think it would be a mistake to say it was all about UNICAL, it was all about some pipeline. It was about a lot of things, and great things have happened on the ground in Afghanistan. Very bad things have happened too, and we should investigate it and hold people accountable, but let's not lose sight of the amazing changes which have taken place.
I want to understand how much of what the writer is saying is true. I don't mind some criticism. I get it all the time. Was Karzai a UNICAL consultant?
At one point, apparently, when they were seeking to look into ways they could build the pipeline through the west of the country, I think he was brought on as a consultant. I had heard the allegation before, but
that wasn't his primary job, or
not at all. He's a tribal. He was the deputy foreign minister of Afghanistan in the early 1990s. The Taliban, he fled, you know, after the civil war started and the Taliban came in, and his father was killed by the Taliban. I mean, he's a tribal elder. There's plenty of things about him that can be criticized, and there are plenty of things that can be criticized about UNOCL and that whole deal and how they wanted a pipeline and how they were willing to support the Taliban. But it would be a mistake to just make him a puppet lackey. It's a more complex story than that.
Let me read one more comment from our weblog that I think is in the same vein, but it's from Alice, who is a frequent caller, and she writes, "John and Mark, I do not believe we should be in Afghanistan. They did not attack us. 9/11 was an inside job. I've read Jim Marr's book, Inside Job. It sounds too criminal to be possible, but that can be said of just about everything our government is doing. Are either of you familiar with this book or David Ray Griffin?" How do you answer, Alice, John?
Don't know what to say. Not familiar with the allegations. All I can say is back in 2002, when I was in Afghanistan and the Taliban was in power, they certainly did have many foreign groups training on their soil to launch terrorist operations in Kashmir and in Europe. I don't know, you know, the exact connections. I'm not an intelligence official, but I'm certainly glad the Taliban is out of power.
John,
I think the more important thing is how do we just deal with the situation as it's given to us, and make Afghanistan stable and get the U.S. out of there as quickly as possible.
I got one last question, and I'm afraid you only have 30 seconds to answer it. It has to do with Hamid Karzai. Do you think he will be able to use his influence to prevent future American attacks on Afghani detainees?
I think the most important thing is actually not Karzai, but the American people. I mean, there's been a lot of complaints about this abuse, but at the end of the day, you got to call your senator and say, why aren't you opening hearings into this abuse? I'm outraged. Our standing abroad is in shambles. We got to do something about it. Make the Congress, make the Senate hold hearings and appoint a special independent counsel. You should call your senator, call John Warner, call whoever you need to call. Make it happen.
John Sifton, thank you very much for taking this time to be on the Inside Scoop. I know all of us learned a lot more about Afghanistan than we knew to begin with. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got no show, of course, tomorrow on Sunday at 6 p.m. I'm going to give the Sunday Weekly Review. Monday, Memorial Day, there is no show, and then comes Debate Tuesday. And Wednesday and Thursday, I'll be reporting live from the Campaign for America Future, the largest gathering of progressive leaders, well, since the Democratic National Convention. That's all next week here on the Inside Scoop. Thank you for listening in. This is Mark Levine signing off.